Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and Israel as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. Tensions escalating in the West Bank, where Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians in a single day. And in Turkey, emergency workers are trying to rescue over a dozen miners who remain trapped following a tragic explosion. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's leader says the Muslim world can claim its rightful place in global geopolitics through unity and overcoming the temptations of enemies, especially the United States and Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said to have unity, Muslims should work together to preserve their common interests and thwart the plots of arrogant powers. The leader also noted that the differences between the two major branches of Islam should not lead to disputes among Muslims. He said there are extremists among both Sunnis and Shias, but have nothing to do with either. The leader stressed that those who inflame the sentiments of one faith in the name of support for another should be seriously confronted. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the enemies have been seeking to drive a wedge among Muslims by creating and empowering Israel. He warned that divergence among Muslim nations has paved the way for intensified crackdowns and atrocities against people in Palestine and other Islamic countries. The leader also described the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and the Israeli regime as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. He stressed, however, that unity is still possible among Muslim nations through hard work and perseverance in the face of difficulties. Ayatollah Khamenei cited the example of the Islamic Republic of Iran, saying it stood up to former world powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, when it was a sapling. The leader said now that the Islamic Republic has turned into a mighty tree, no one should even consider uprooting it. Ayatollah Khamenei was speaking at a meeting with the participants in the Islamic Unity Conference, which was held in Tehran in recent days. Masoud Shajara is with the Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says unity among Muslims is the only way to thwart U.S. plots.
Now, very clear for everyone to see that what has come in the last years as a result of policy of United States and the Western world, in not just in the region of Middle East, but everywhere else. I mean, look, it's very easy. Just look at Afghanistan, look at Iraq, look at Syria, look at Libya. You see that there is a destruction, total destruction of the civil society, destruction of the infrastructure, and what they have replaced it with is really chaotic and sort of an environment where it's not fit for ordinary human beings to live. And the solution is that the Muslims to come together. Muslims, in reality, are on receiving end of all these oppression, and they need to unite and they need to stand.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has decried the, quote, meddlesome remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the recent riots in the country. Nasser Kanani said Macron's condemnation of Iran's response to the violence encourages rioters and outlaws. The spokesman said the condemnation comes while the French government itself has threatened to forcibly break an oil refinery strike that began almost 3 weeks ago. Kanani stressed that the flagrant hypocrisy once again proves that many Western governments use human rights as a tool to achieve their political goals. Riots erupted in Iran after a young woman died days after collapsing at a police station. A forensic report has dismissed allegations that she was beaten up, saying she died due to an underlying medical condition. And the Iranian foreign minister has criticized Western double standards in condemning Iran's response to the recent riots in the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the EU never gives such a response to similar events in Western countries. He is urging European officials to adopt a realistic approach to the issue. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell. The top Iranian diplomat added that the Islamic Republic enjoys strong popular support and an efficient democracy. He stressed that Iran is not a land of velvet and color coups. In turn, Borrell assured Amir Abdullahian that the EU does not wish to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. Some EU officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest, threatening sanctions. Iran has warned of retaliatory measures in case of such a move. Elsewhere, Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians in a single day in the occupied West Bank. Troops killed a Palestinian man late on Friday over a shooting attack at a settlement near the city of Ramallah. They arrested another Palestinian in connection with that incident, which left an Israeli settler wounded. Earlier on Friday, Israeli troops attacked the Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians. One of them was a doctor who was shot while attending to the injured. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year in the occupied territories, most of them since March. That's when the regime launched an ongoing crackdown following a series of deadly attacks by Palestinians against Israelis. Resistance groups say the attacks are in response to Israeli atrocities. Monica Andil is our correspondent in the occupied territories and joins us now for the latest on Israel's ethnic cleansing genocidal campaign. Mona, what's the latest?
Well, this morning, the Israeli soldiers raided Deir Shrir town in Ramallah. It's the hometown of the Palestinian whom the Israeli forces claim that he carried out the shooting at the illegal settlement of Beit Il last night. Qais Shuja'iya from Deir Shrir, of course. Two Palestinians approached the illegal settlement of Beit Il near the Palestinian refugee camp of Al-Jalazon, opened fire, wounded an Israeli settler. The Israeli forces responded, killing Qais Shuja'iya and took his body. Then this morning, the Israeli forces raided Deir Shrir and they attacked the relatives and family members of Qais Shuja'iya after raiding his house and arrested three Palestinians from Deir Shrir. The Israeli forces have said that the soldiers have also detained Mohammed Oude. He was the second Palestinian with Qais Shuja'iya and whom he carried the shooting last night at the illegal settlement of Beit Il. As you have said, yesterday alone, three Palestinians were killed in the occupied West Bank, two of them during a raid to Jenin refugee camp, northern the occupied West Bank, and a third Palestinian had succumbed to his injuries he sustained last month in an operation in the Jordan Valley. The 17-year-old Palestinian was originally from Jenin. Palestinians every day are doing their utmost to prove to the Israeli forces, of course, according to the different political powers and experts, they are doing their utmost to prove that despite the Israeli aggression, illegal policies, the atrocities, the crimes being committed against the Palestinians, however, Palestinians are still adherent to the choice of resistance. And now we are speaking about armed resistance. It's not only about taking part in protests and demonstrations. However, Palestinians are also being engaged in armed resistance to tell the Israelis that they are occupiers and that the Israeli occupation must come to an end.
Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there, our correspondent, joining us live from occupied Ramallah. Moving on, the death toll from Friday's coal mine blast in northern Turkey rises to 40 as rescuers are trying to save some workers still believed to be trapped there. The Interior Ministry earlier said 58 miners were able to come out unharmed. It remains unclear if the latest death figure includes 15 workers the rescuers were searching for. Some 110 people had been working underground when a methane blast occurred in the mine located in the Black Sea town of Amasra. That is, according to the health minister, 11 of those pulled out alive are being treated in hospital. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to fly to the accident site. It was the deadliest industrial accident in years in Turkey. Moving on to tensions between Russia and the West, where a war of words is now escalating over Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin has warned of the global consequences of any NATO military offensive against his forces.
In any case, direct contact, direct clash of NATO troops with the Russian army is a very dangerous move, which could lead to a global catastrophe. I hope that those who are saying this are smart enough not to take such a step.
Putin was addressing a news conference in Kazakhstan. On Thursday, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said the Russian army would be annihilated if Putin launches a nuclear attack against Ukraine. And NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg also said that Russia would face severe consequences if it uses a nuclear weapon against Ukraine. Russia has said it will use nuclear weapons if its security, including that of the newly annexed regions of Ukraine, is threatened. While Ukraine has made recent gains in the country's Kherson region and the northern part of Donbass, there have been disturbing reports of reprisals against the so-called pro-Russia collaborators. Our correspondent in Donbass investigates.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Zhenimil Rebeznoy, Donbass.
U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered his national security strategy. He has again pointed to China as the biggest threat to U.S. security and the world order. That being the case, the question would be, why does the U.S. take a militaristic approach to contain China, threatening global peace and stability in the process?
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and his predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
When speaking about inequality and discrimination, the first country that comes to mind is the United States of America, or, as the situation goes on, the disunited States of America. In just a small example, Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "Billionaires have become a truly worldwide phenomenon. Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. And now, the Credit Suisse Research Institute has just published its broader annual census of the world's super rich, an analysis that finds grand mega million fortunes in nearly every nation. But some nations, the Credit Suisse analysis also shows, host far more of these fortunes than others. And one nation, the United States of America, sits in a wealth class all its own. The United States boasts 39.2% of the world's millionaires. China sits second at 9.9%, with Japan third at 5.4%. The contrast becomes even more striking as we step up even higher into the world of the fabulously wealthy. Some 53% of the global deep pockets worth at least $100 million call the United States of America home. What explains this overwhelming U.S. dominance within the ranks of the world's super rich? The release of another new annual set of stats from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. points to one prime piece of answer: corporate executive compensation. The Economic Policy Institute has emerged over recent years as America's most perceptive source of CEO pay data. An analyst from the Institute earlier this week released their latest yearly update. The headline stat from this new EPI analysis says corporate chiefs at the 350 top American firms that trade on the stock market last year realized an average $27.8 million in compensation, an 11.1% increase over their previous year's pay, and a record 399 times more than the take-home of typical American workers. Some context can help here. Back in 1965, top U.S. CEOs averaged just 20 times more than the annual compensation of typical American workers. In 1989, a quarter century later, that gap was still only running 59 to 1. The gap since then has multiplied nearly sevenfold. Overall, U.S. CEO compensation has increased 1,460% since 1978, adjusting for inflation. The pay increase for typical U.S. workers over that same time span, just 18%. Rising corporate executive compensation, note EPI's Josh Bivens and Jory Kondra, has fueled the growth of top 1% and top 0.1% incomes, leaving fewer of the gains of economic growth for ordinary workers and widening the gap between the very high earners and the bottom 90%. This increase in U.S. executives' pay has extended far beyond CEO suits. All top corporate officers have feasted in the fabulous windfall. Amazon, for instance, last year generously shared the wealth well beyond the chief executive level. Amazon CEO Andrew Jassy ended the year up $212.7 million. But Amazon's web services chief Adam Selipsy had no reason to complain either. His compensation for the year, $81.4 million. David Clark, Amazon's worldwide consumer chief, enjoyed a lucrative year as well. His pay totaled $56 million. Amazon's most typical warehouse workers, meanwhile, took home $31,705 last year. The pay gap between U.S. corporate execs and workers gives no sign of shrinking anytime soon. And that shouldn't surprise us. Corporate executives sit on each other's boards of directors. These executives have little incentive to rein in CEO pay in hard economic times and every incentive to insist that only continued high executive pay can keep in place the quality leadership that hard times so dramatically demand. Just how much does all U.S. current corporate executive compensation contribute to the wealth of America's wealthiest? Quite a bit. Between 1978 and 2020, the latest year with comparable stats available, the overall inflation-adjusted annual earnings of nation's top 0.1% jumped 385%. CEO compensation during those same years, EPI notes, grew nearly four times as fast. The bottom line, America's distribution of income and wealth will remain ridiculously top-heavy until people start limiting the rewards, continuing to rush and gush into U.S. corporate executive suits. That limit could come in any one of several different forms. Let's start with taxes. In the two decades after the Second World War, individual income over $200,000 faced a federal income tax rate that annually hovered around 90%. That tax pressure served to deflate executive compensation. Why bother skimming for outrageously high executive pay, after all, when Uncle Sam stood ready to tax away most of any windfall? Another approach to corporate pay reform, limiting the gap between executive and worker compensation, has been steadily gaining momentum over the past decade. San Francisco and Oregon's Portland now levy higher tax rates on executive pay that runs over 100 times worker pay. At the state level, legislative proposals along the same line are gaining ground. Nationally, as inequality.org details, progressive lawmakers are working to link federal government contracting and subsidies to CEO worker pay differentials. Their goal, denying federal dollars to corporations with wide pay gaps between executives and workers. Corporate America's continuing failure to limit those gaps plays out dramatically in the latest Credit Suisse Research Institute annual comprehensive stats on national mean and median individual wealth. One example, the United States last year averaged just over $579,000 in wealth per adult, almost double France's $322,000 average. But the most typical, the median French adult, held a net worth of just under $140,000, almost $50,000 more than the wealth of the most typical U.S. adult. And on the U.S. rampant inequality and discrimination, Global Times wrote, according to the Native American Rights Fund, Native American voters face 11 common barriers to political participation, including limited government services and a lack of funding for elections. Canada shocked the world with the discovery of alarming numbers of children's remains and unmarked Aboriginal burials at the site of boarding school. The incarceration rate of Indigenous Australian people is 15 times higher than that of non-Indigenous Australians, and the death rate in detention is on the rise, causing family separation and seriously undermining the development of Indigenous communities. What's more, the US systematic discrimination and inequality faced by Indigenous people has not been improved by the implementation of post-pandemic economic and social recovery plans. American Indians and Alaska Natives have long had far higher unemployment rates than other ethnic groups, and the gap has widened during the post-pandemic economic recovery period. According to the recent review conclusions of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Indigenous people's food security and women's rights are not guaranteed, and the willingness and measures of the United States of America to fulfill its commitment to the protection of Indigenous people's rights are seriously insufficient. It is noted that the welfare of Indigenous children in the U.S. is still not effectively protected, and violence and crimes against Indigenous women and girls are still rampant, which greatly hinders the recovery of Indigenous communities from the harm caused by the pandemic.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's leader has highlighted the importance of Islamic unity in preserving the Muslims' common interests and foiling the plots of arrogant powers. In an address to participants of a conference on Islamic unity held in Tehran, Ayatollah Khamenei has warned that divergence among Muslim nations has paved the way for intensified atrocities against Palestinians by Israel. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll try to shed some light on the root cause of such divergence and its consequences for Muslims. On tonight's Spotlight, we have manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El Najem, joining us from Toronto. And also attorney, activist, and political analyst, Zakir Ahmed Maya, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
General, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. El Najem in Toronto, leader of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the Muslim world can claim its rightful place in global geopolitics through unity. How important is this issue of unity?
Yes, would like to congratulate the Muslim world and all the lovers of the Prophet Muhammad on the anniversary of his birth. And this was the central point of why they were meeting here and having this unified conference and inviting Sunni and other sects of the Muslim faith to come to Iran and to speak about the important facts and the problems that the Islamic Ummah is facing. And the unity is actually the essential key to strengthen this Ummah, meaning this nation, and to defeat the enemies, because the enemies, you know, their plots and their project is to divide and conquer, and to cause seditions is one of their main goals. And they've been doing that in many different Muslim countries once they were able to, you know, invade and interfere in the internal affairs of these countries. And we see what happened, for instance, in Afghanistan. We see what happened in Iraq. We see what happened in Syria. We see what happened in many countries before that, even Lebanon, where the U.S. were and their allies, obviously, and their puppets were working to cause sectarian strife and you know, cause internal problems and divisions. And you know, the bloodshed that happens, it causes problems for the future, that people want to avenge and people want to fight for their rights or what they've lost. And at that point, this will just gradually keep bringing you know, problems to the Islamic Ummah. But we got through this phase recently in certain countries because they were able to unite and were able to fight the enemy and understand the problems and the issues that we're dealing with. And Sayyid Khamenei is a very wise leader. He has kept the Islamic Republic of Iran and all the Muslims inside Iran unified. And he's also issued Islamic you know, laws where he says that it's not permissible and it's you cannot disrespect high figures and revered figures of other sects, especially the Sunni Muslims, because they are the majority in the Islamic world, you know, as a population of Muslims. And he's always tried to maintain that unity. While we have other puppet regimes that are working for the U.S. and for the interests of Britain, such as the Saudi regime that is, you know, that has the Wahhabi sect as their state-sponsored doctrine, have always worked to cause divisions and hatred and sectarian strife and killings and bloodshed between Muslims. And this affected the whole Islamic world. And we see what they tried to do that and implant that also in Yemen recently, but they failed because of the wise leadership of, for instance, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. And we've seen the wise leadership of Sayyid Sistani, that even when holy shrines in Iraq that are very revered and important and holy for the Shia Muslims were bombed, they were, okay. Sayyid Sistani quickly called for, you know, unity and to not fall for these traps of, you know, sedition and internal, you know, problems.
Let's bring in our guest from Johannesburg, Zakir Ahmed Mayet, in on the discussion as well on the issue of sowing divisions among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei says enemies have been seeking to drive a wedge among Muslims by creating and empowering Israel. I want to get your thoughts on that comment. And who benefits, actually, from these divisions?
Definitely. The tactic of the Western world and imperial powers has always been to divide and conquer. It has been a principle that is enshrined in their military doctrine and as well as their foreign policy stances. So it comes as no surprise when the illegitimate state and the foreign body and the cancerous body of the Zionist entity is placed within the heart of the Muslim world and exercises its foreign policy and military policy in line with what I've just described. The only party that succeeds from these types of divisionist policies are those that are seeking to destroy the Ummah and those that are seeking to occupy and perpetuate apartheid. Those that are the victims are the unwitting individuals that fall into the trap of sectarianism, takfiri ideology, and finds problems and divisions amongst their own brethren. This is a clear indication that we are deviating from the law of Allah, the law of the Creator in Surah Al-Imran. It is very clear, and hold firmly onto the rope of Allah and do not divide amongst yourself. The Almighty says very clearly there that if you have divided amongst yourselves, you were fighting each other once upon a time, and you were on the edge of the pit of hellfire, and he has saved you from that. What does that mean? That when you fight amongst yourselves, when you find fault amongst yourselves, that is where hellfire awaits you. And this is the clearest indication, and the respected leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Khamenei, has given that nasiha, that advice, to the Ummah and humanity at large. We are fighting for truth and justice. They spoke about the just war and the just peace, and that is what a Muslim seeks, the Ummah seeks. It's justice for each and every one of them, and including the larger population, mankind. Therefore, deviating from that would mean that we are aligning ourselves with Zionist powers, we are aligning ourselves with imperial powers, and if we hold firmly to the rope of God, do not divide amongst ourselves, fight for truth and justice, it is very clear that we find ourselves opposing imperialism, opposing Israel, opposing colonialism.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Mayat. Also, Ayatollah Khamenei said in his address, the unipolar world in which one or two states impose their will on other countries is no longer accepted, and that this quote-unquote unipolar world order is losing its legitimacy. What is your perspective on those comments? Are we on the cusp of a major geopolitical power shift, in your opinion?
Most definitely, we're seeing it now. In fact, this isn't the analysis of just our own circles or the respected supreme leader, not at all. This is the analysis from even the Western world. If you look at Colonel Douglas McGregor, he has spoken about this. Individuals such as Jordan Peterson, although we may disagree with many of the views that these individuals have expressed, what we cannot deny is that they even see the writing on the wall. And the writing is very clear. This is a cultural war from the Western world versus Russia, where they're trying to impose their values upon Russia and trying to re-establish the unipolar world, where Russia has now taken a very clear stance with the rest of the BRICS countries, and they are now pushing back and they're saying no longer are we going to accept this. What does this mean? What does this spell out for the ordinary individual? The ordinary individual now is empowered. We are no longer subject to the hand of U.S. imperialism, where they can parade through the world under the banner of trying to liberate us, while it's more like looting our resources, destroying our people, and inflicting a pure occupation that is nothing short of inhumane, barbaric, and a pure violation of international law. So what we have now in before us is a very exciting time for the world right now. Yes, there's turmoil. Yes, there's death and destruction. But the world is being rewritten. And this is what the respected leader is drawing our attention to, is that the world map is being rewritten in such a way that we hope that the structures of imperialism, colonialism, and apartheid are going to be debunked and unhinged, and what we will see is a new just world order, where it's not a unipolar world, but one that is in balance.
For us, Najim, elsewhere in his address, Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to the Palestinian issue and normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime. He described the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and the Israeli regime as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. Do you see it in that light as well? And what are these countries gaining from this betrayal?
I mean, the height of this betrayal is just large, you know, because it's huge. I mean, it's very painful that every day we hear about the atrocities and the crimes that the Zionist regime commits inside Palestine. Today they killed a doctor. A few days ago they killed a little child, you know, an infant. A few days before that, you know, today they killed also another two youth, as I read. I mean, it's continuous, you know, this even just the rhetoric of the Zionists and the settlers and some of these politicians that are in the Israeli regime, you know, calling for the shooting of Palestinians that throw rocks. For instance, today there was an extremist politician. These criminals, day and night, you know, commit these gruesome crimes and barbaric crimes and hurt the Muslim Ummah by also this, you know, disrespecting the Holy Aqsa Mosque. And, you know, how could you go towards and incline towards supporting those people that are killing your own people? Like, you're supposedly Muslim. So when you see another Muslim and he's being, you know, oppressed, you're supposed to stand with him and support him. And you're going towards helping the oppressor and growing his movement. This is a great betrayal. And this is also causing disunity between the Islamic Ummah. And it's also causing a distortion between the nations itself. For instance, the nations of the nation of UAE or the nation of Bahrain, the nation itself, they remember when they were watching, you know, clips and videos of the Palestinians, or they were taught in school to support the Palestinians, and all of a sudden their government now or their regime started to teach them that, no, we should support the Israelis. This is causing major confusion and distortion and dividing the Ummah instead of them getting closer to the oppressed people. And we see, you know, the Hajj, for instance, the holy pilgrimage of Hajj. This shows a unity of all Muslims praying towards one place. And we should all remember that this Qibla, this direction, was before, long time ago, was Al-Aqsa, was Masjid Al-Aqsa. You know, this is where we all pray towards. And this place is occupied. And our Muslim brothers and sisters and humanity is suffering over there. And something has to happen. We need to support these Muslim people. And Sayyid Khamenei is one of the main leaders and the primary leader supporting the Palestinian cause. You know, not just by speaking. No, his nation and his government and his army and his forces are supporting the Palestinians by arming them up, by the media such as Press TV speaking about the Palestinian issue all day and night, undeterred. By him even all the time wearing the kufiyah. Every time Sayyid Khamenei comes out, you see him wearing a kufiyah, is the Palestinian symbol. Which other leader does this, that always wears this and remembers the Palestinian cause on his shoulders? He carries this burden on him because he cares about the Palestinian nation. And right now, there's a major campaign in the world to try to divide the Iranian nation because they're so fearful of this great leader and this great government and this great nation of Iran that should stay unified and fight these distortions and fight this sedition and fight this anarchy and destabilization inside Iran, this great government that supports the popular mobilization forces in Iraq.
Very well.
ISIS was taken over, yes, and supporting all the oppressed.
Zakir Ahmad Dumayet, on the issue of the normalization deals with the Israeli regime, do you think that these deals are intended to sow more division among regional countries?
Most definitely. It's an attempt to fracture the Muslim world. And so the loss of hope within the hearts of the Palestinian people, however, this is very clear from the Israeli sources. If you look at their military sources, they have admitted that this has been a colossal failure. The only thing that these Abraham Accords and these normalizations have proven to the world is that you have leaders who are prepared to trade values for economic advantage. This is the type of leadership that is running the Muslim world in large part, that they are prepared to trade their values for a few dollars. That is the exchange. And this has now created a very clear picture to the peoples of the world. Who do you support and who you don't? And this is particularly why, and I'll echo what my brother has said, that this is particularly why the Islamic Republic has been targeted with these recent wave of protests to try and sow discord and break the backs of the Iranian people and the Iranian nation and the support for the Palestinian people. This is not going to happen. These are the words of Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Khamenei, that they tried to sweep away the sapling of the Islamic Revolution, and they failed. And now it has grown into a mighty tree with very deep roots. You cannot topple this tree. And similarly, what they are trying to do is a two-faced project. One was normalization, trading your values for monetary gain. And the second one that is coming forward is that they are trying to sow the individual religion concept within the hearts of the Ummah instead of viewing it as a collective. So what it is that Islam is now religion for the individual, his own belief and his own conscience, and therefore it opens the door to perversion. No, this is a collective religion. Our strength lies in our unity. And this was the underlying message of the 36th Conference of Islamic Unity. We must remain together. We must remain firm. And one of the key points that joins the hearts of everyone is this particular thing, that is the issue of Palestine. It's an issue of justice. It is an issue of truth. And you cannot turn a blind eye, because then you would be trading your own values and your own humanity.
Professor Najima, in your opinion, are the U.S. and the Israelis trying to depreciate the issue of the occupation? If Arab countries downplay it and do not prioritize it for the region, then it'll just be easier to get other countries to downplay it as well. Am I right?
Yes, for sure. I mean, the world is focused right now on putting sanctions on Iran. They're putting sanctions on Russia, today NATO president spoke out saying that, you know, he's against the annexation of Ukrainian lands and stuff like this. And then he never speaks about what the Palestinian annexation and all the settlements and all the thefts and all the killings and Sheikh Jarrah. You know, where is this NATO? He only sees in one eye. He only sees one location or one area or one religion. I don't understand what these people see. It's all biased. They are, you can say they're racist, they're Islamophobic, you know, they're it's pure double standard, pure hypocrisy. They don't care about humanity. They only care about a certain type of humanity, you know, that's based on their, you know, like they have like the supremacy kind of like, you know, viewpoint and agenda. It's very, very bad what's happening in the world right now. But I think Sayyid Khamenei is setting the grounds. He's setting the right equations, and he's spreading awareness while the world is attacking him, you know, on a heavy level. We see on social media circulating major attacks on Sayyid Khamenei, calling him a dictator, where he has nothing to do with dictatorship. He's fighting the dictators. He's fighting the imperialist systems. He's fighting the Zionist regimes. He's trying to help people break out of these chains. He was elected by the assembly of experts. You know, he didn't even want to rule the country. He didn't even want power. Sayyid Khamenei stepped out of the his chair. He didn't want that. It was a big responsibility. But the assembly of experts, they pushed him and wanted him to stand there because they believed that he was the right man and he was the wisest man for this position. And Iran is a democratic Islamic system, and the world needs to understand this, that the Islamic democratic system is different than the Western hypocrisy and their so-called democracy that we see now. Freedom of expression is being suppressed on a heavy level, where they're taking people off the platforms on TikTok, on Instagram, on WhatsApp, on everything, just because they express a different view than their view and a different trend than their trend and a different direction than their direction. So they are exposing themselves. You know, they put sanctions on Press TV. Why would you do that? That's obviously you want to suppress another side and your opposition. That means you don't really believe in freedom of press. This slowly, slowly is exposing the real face of this so-called Western democracy and, you know, what they promote and say that they are actually following.
Zakir Ahmed Mayet, we have about a minute left. I want to get your final thoughts to wrap up the program.
The final thought is that there's a very clear book that was written by Brigadier General S.K. Malik in 1979, The Quranic Concepts of War. And he says that the believer is constantly in a state of war against the principles of tyranny and persecution. It is our job to fight this. And we can only fight these injustices if we remain united. Do not hold on firmly onto the rope of Allah and do not divide amongst yourselves. We are all part of one Ummah, as one of the key leaders of Hamas said at the conference, Dr. Khalid Ghadoumi. He said that we have one God, we have one book, and we have one Qibla. We need to remain united. It is a time of great change, and our hearts need to remain firm and connected to one another. And by the will of God, we will see justice within our lifetimes.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayet joining us from Johannesburg. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means
to... Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
Ya ilaha كل شيء ومليك يا رب.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
يا خالق كل شيء وورثا.
So dear listeners, we are talking about informing our heart and what relation this has with our ubudiyya. Now, of course, when we are talking about the heart, we are talking about the inner dimensions of our being. A cordial discipline of worship, especially the worship which involves invoking, and this kind of dhikr, the remembrance of Allah, is informing. Now, in the Arabic, this is known as tafheem. Now, this tafheem is what? It is informing the heart and constantly teaching the heart. Now, this tafheem is to take this heart and at the beginning, just like a child who's not able to speak and is wanted to be taught, this heart also is not able to speak in the initial parts of our ubudiyya. And so, the heart must be taught how to speak. Now, this speaking, of course, is the remembrance and the dhikr, the invocation and the remembrance, as we said, of Allah. And so when the heart begins to speak and do the hamd,